Ho, 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 everyone. This is our Christmas podcast.
Our Christmas special.
Welcome to our Christmas special podcast. Our special Christmas podcast. Mm-hmm. Because we care about Christmas. Mm-hmm. Indeed, we do. So I thought it'd be fun to find, like, classic kind of Christmassy-themed stories. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, from the classics to read. And I have several, so I don't know if you want to get right into it.
Sure.
All right. Have you ever read the O. Henry story?
No.
The Gift of the Magi? Are you familiar with it? Have you read it? Okay.
You've heard it.
You probably heard of it, huh, Jess? Well, I'm saying no so that then you can read it.
Oh. Well, she's going to read it no matter what.
I am going to read it whether you know it or not. So I think you'll enjoy it, though, because, you know, you probably forget.
All right. Forget one of those classic Christmas tales of all time.
Well, maybe the details you forgot.
Maybe.
So here is The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. $1.87. That was all. And 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man.
Is this about me going to Dunkin' Donuts?
60 pennies.
It's your Kramer. Dilemma.
Yeah. You go to Dunkin', you just dump out a pocket full of pennies.
Maybe that's where you got the idea. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with the silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implied.
What?
How's that for writing?
Yeah.
Three 40. Times Stella counted it. $1.87. And the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it. Which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating.
Oh my gosh.
Right? While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, meaning sobs to sniffles. Mm-hmm. Take a look at the home. A furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad.
Jeez.
That means not having much money.
Right.
In the vestibule below was a letterbox into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 per week. Now, when the income was shrunk to $20, though, they were thinking seriously of contracting to a modest and unassuming D. But whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim, and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della, which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months, with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses had been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him. Something fine and rare and sterling. Something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim.
Aww.
There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. It's spelled P-I-E-R.
Pier, like they got it at Pier 1?
Probably, yeah.
Not for...
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think it's just like a kind of mirror.
Oh, for like doing coke on the coffee table?
In your $8 flat.
Yeah. A very thin and very agile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, obtain a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly, she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly, she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now, there were two possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window someday to dry just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor, with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed just to see him pluck at his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet.
Good job.
Nice. On went her old brown jacket. On went her old brown hat.
Plunk.
With a whirl of skirts and with the brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and down the stairs to the street.
Bye!
There's no one there. There's no one there to say bye to.
There's the apartment.
Okay. Bye. Goodbye.
She's wishing it well in her absence.
Yeah.
Bye, Felicia.
Bye, Felicia apartment.
This is good night, Moon. Goodbye, apartment.
Felicia flat.
Where she stopped, the sign read, Madame Sofroni, hair goods of all kinds. One flight up, Della ran and collected herself, panting. Madame, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked the Sofroni. That's supposed to be like an exotic kind of name, and this woman is
fairly gross.
Yeah. Will you buy my hair? Asked Della. I buy hair, said Madame. Take your hat off and let's have a sight at the looks of it. Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madame, lifting the mask with a practiced hand. Give it to me quick, said Della.
Give it to her, babe.
Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hashed metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present.
20 bones.
She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not by meretricious ornamentation, as all good things should do.
Platinum to go with this gold watch.
Yeah. Tacky. She has no taste.
No.
It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value. The description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with the 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way a little to prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love, which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror long, carefully, and critically.
A truant schoolboy.
If Jim doesn't kill me, she said to herself, before he takes a second look at me, he'll say, I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his step on the stair, away down on the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit for saying a little silent prayer about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I am still pretty." The door opened, and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very nervous. Poor fellow, he was only 22, and to be burdened with a family. He needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves.
I would have thought they were like 40.
I know, me too. Nope.
Jim stopped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, disgust, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly with that peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him. "Jim, darling," she cried, "don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow out again, and you won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you." "You've cut off your hair?" asked Jim, laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor. "Cut it off and sold it," said Della. "Don't you like me just as well anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I?" Jim looked about the room curiously. "You say your hair is gone?" he said, with an air almost of idiocy. "You needn't look for it," said Della. "It's sold. I tell you, sold and gone, too. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered," she went on with sudden serious sweetness, "but nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put the chops on, Jim?" Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds, let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week, or $1 million a year, what is the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it upon the table. "Don't make any mistake, Del," he said, "about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that would make me like my girl any less."
Aww.
"But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first." White fingers and nimble tore at the string and paper, and then an ecstatic scream of joy, and then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the lord of the flat. For there lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoise shell with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear and the beautifully vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession. And now they were hers. But the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look up with dim eyes and a smile and say, "My hair grows so fast, Jim." And then Della leapt up like a little singed cat and cried, "Oh, oh!" Jim had not yet seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with the reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. "Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You'll have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Dal," said he, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep them a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now, suppose you put the chops on." The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat, who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of the house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that all who give gifts, these two were the wisest. Oh, all who give and receive gifts, such as they, are wisest. Everywhere they are wisest. They are the Magi.
Yeah,
what do you
think? That's sad.
Sad? That always bothers me.
Why?
Because he got the raw end of that deal in, like, so many ways. Like, yeah. Her hair will grow back. But he's also an idiot, because why would you get rid of, like, an heir? Like, it was your grandfather's watch and then your father. Like, I don't know. That one just bothers me. I don't really like that story just because of that, because it annoys me.
Yeah.
That her hair will grow back. Like, it's if I were true. Her, I'd be like, sell these combs and get your watch back, dummy. Like, that was your dad's and your grandpa's watch. I don't know.
I know. Maybe she could ask, they could go to the pawnbroker and say, look, give me, like, another year. I'm going to sell my hair again and buy back.
I know, but did he pawn it or did he sell it?
Yeah.
Sounds like he sold it.
Maybe he did.
Plus the interest alone, I doubt they could afford to pawn, to buy it back if they pawned it.
I don't know enough about things. Yeah, it's true. Her hair will grow back, and she will get to use those combs.
Yeah.
I don't like if she's greedy.
He's missing his heirloom. Yeah. But, you know, the point.
I know. It still annoys me.
They sacrificed.
It's not a fair comparison, though.
They were each proud of for the other. That's the point.
Yeah, I would get that if it were an even trade, but it's not. Because her hair will come back. And she, even fast, she said. She admittedly, her hair grows fast.
It's true. You're right.
I don't know.
All right. You want to hear? Well, this is a sweet little story.
Okay. What's it called?
This is, the author is unknown. It's from a teacher. It's called Christmas is for Love.
Okay.
Yeah.
The teacher when? Obviously not now. They're not allowed to say Christmas. Assuming.
Yeah, I don't know when it was. I don't have that detail. All right. Christmas is for love. It is for joy, for giving and sharing, for laughter, for reuniting with family and friends, for tinsel and brightly covered packages. But mostly Christmas is for love. I had not believed this until a small elfin-like pupil with wide innocent eyes and soft rosy cheeks gave me a wondrous gift one Christmas. Matthew was a 10-year-old orphan who lived with his aunt, a bitter middle-aged woman greatly annoyed with the burden of caring for her dead sister's son.
Jeez.
I know.
Sounds like a delight.
Right? She never failed to remind young Matthew, if it hadn't been for her generosity, he would be a vagrant, homeless waif.
Sounds like me and Declan. Which doesn't make any sense, because you're not dead.
That's true.
A vagrant, homeless waif.
Yeah.
Still, with all the scolding and chilliness at home, he was a sweet and gentle child.
That
sounds like that. I had not noticed Matthew particularly until he began staying after class each day, at the risk of arousing his aunt's anger, so I learned later, to help me straighten up the room.
Is this Matilda's teacher, too? Sounds the same.
They substituted the name.
Yeah.
We did this quietly and comfortably, not speaking much, but enjoying the solitude of that hour of the day. When we did talk, Matthew spoke mostly of his mother. Though he was quite young when she died, he remembered a kind, gentle, loving woman who always spent time with him. As Christmas drew near, however, Matthew failed to stay after school each day. I looked forward to his coming, and when the days passed and he continued to scamper hurriedly from the room after class, I stopped him one afternoon and asked him why he no longer helped me in the room. I told him how I had missed him, and his large brown eyes lit up eagerly as he replied, "Did you really miss me?" I explained how he had been my best helper. "I was making you a surprise," he whispered confidentially. "It's for Christmas." With that, he became embarrassed and dashed from the room. He didn't stay after school anymore after that. Finally came the last school day before Christmas. Matthew crept slowly into the room late that afternoon with his hands concealing something behind his back. "I have your present," he said timidly when I looked up. "I hope you like it." He held out his hands, and there, lying in his small palms, was a tiny wooden box. "It's beautiful, Matthew. Is there something in it?" I asked, opening the top to look inside. "Oh, you can't see what's in it," he replied. "And you can't touch it, or taste it, or feel it. But Mother always said it makes you feel good all the time, warm on cold nights, and safe when you're all alone." I gazed into the empty box. "What is it, Matthew?" I asked gently, "that will make me feel so good?" "It's love," he whispered softly. "And Mother always said it's best when you give it away." He turned and quietly left the room. So now I keep a small box, crudely made of scraps of wood, on the piano in my living room, and only smile when inquiring friends raise quizzical eyebrows when I explain to them there is love in it. Yes, Christmas is for gaiety, mirth, song, and for good and wondrous gifts, but mostly Christmas is for love.
Aww. Aww. That story was full of gaiety.
It's true.
Yeah, I thought you'd like it.
It's cute. It's kind of a bummer, though.
Yeah.
It's a sad one.
Yeah.
I know. There's a lot of sad. Oh, here's a sad one. You want to hear this one?
Are they all sad? Christmas is about love and joy.
Is it, though? I'm starting to wonder.
I know. Apparently not.
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of these stories are like, I don't know how to explain it, like changing people. You know, that the love changes them and...
Like the Grinch.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, like the Grinch.
Do you have the Grinch?
I wish I did.
Yeah, right.
That'd be good. Or can you recite Elf, the Grinch?
Yeah. Okay. The Who's in Whoville. We're hooing around.
And no, she cannot. That answered the question. They're hooing around.
Once upon a
those
time.
Those Who's. It's like Smurfs.
We're smurfing around.
Yeah.
All right, have you ever heard of the Very Selfish Giant?
No.
Really?
I've heard of the Big Friendly Giant.
I've heard of Andre the Giant.
I've heard of the Green Giant.
The Jolly Green Giant.
Yep.
This is the Very Selfish Giant. This is an Oscar Wilde story.
Ooh.
Intended speaking to be of full read of gaiety. To children. All right, ready? This is intended for children.
Uh-oh. Weird children.
Early afternoon, as they were coming from school, the children used to go and play in the giant's garden. It was a large, lovely garden with soft green grass. Here and there over the grass stood beautiful flowers like stars, and there were 12 peach trees that in the springtime broke out into delicate blossoms of pink and pearl, and in the autumn bore rich fruit. The birds sat on the trees and sang so sweetly that the children used to stop their games in order to listen to them. "How happy we are here," they cried to each other. One day, the giant came back. He had been to visit his friend, the Cornish ogre, and had stayed with him for 7 years. After the 7 years were over, he had said all that he had to say, for his conversation was limited, and he determined to return to his own castle. When he arrived, he saw the children playing in the garden. "What are you doing here?" he cried in a very gruff voice. And the children ran away. My own garden is my own garden, said the giant. Anyone can understand that, and I will allow nobody to play in it but myself. So he built a high wall around it and put up a notice board. Trespassers will be prosecuted. He was a very selfish giant. Mm-hmm. The poor children had now nowhere to play. They tried to play on the road, but the road was very dusty and full of hard stones, and they did not like it. They used to wander round the high wall when their lessons were over and talk about the beautiful garden inside. How happy we were there, they said to each other. When the spring came, and all over the country, there were little blossoms and little birds. Only in the garden of the selfish giant was it still winter.
Maybe he's mad because that's his name. You know what I mean? Maybe selfish. He's sick of that nickname.
Well, he's living up to it. The birds did not care to sing in it, as there were no children, and the trees forgot to blossom. Once a beautiful flower put its head out from the grass, but when it saw the notice board, it was so sorry for the children that it slipped back into the ground again and went off to sleep. The only people who were pleased were the snow and the frost. Spring has forgotten this garden, they cried, so we will live here all year round. The snow covered up the grass with her great white cloak, and the frost painted all the trees silver. Then they invited the north wind to stay with them, and he came. He was wrapped in furs, and he roared all day about the garden and blew the chimney pots down. This is a delightful spot, he said. We must ask the hail on a visit. So the hail came. Every day, for 3 hours, he rattled on the roof of the castle until he broke most of the slates, and then he ran round and round the garden as fast as he could go. He was dressed in gray, and his breath was like ice. I cannot understand why the spring is so late in coming, said the selfish giant, as he sat at the window and looked out at his cold, white garden. I hope there will be a change in the weather. But the spring never came, nor the summer. The autumn gave golden fruit to every garden, but to the giant's garden she gave none. He is too selfish, she said. So it was always winter there. And the north wind and the hail and the frost and the snow danced about through the trees. One morning, the giant was lying awake in bed when he heard some lovely music. It sounded so sweet to his ears that he thought it must be the king's musicians passing by.
I love it when you call me Big Pop.
Oh, those king's musicians.
It was really only a little linnet singing outside his window.
Lynette Carolla, Adam Carolla's wife, Lynette.
But it was so long since he had heard a bird sing in this garden that it seemed to him to be the most beautiful music in the world. Then the hail stopped dancing over his head, and the north wind ceased roaring, and a delicious perfume came to him through the open casement.
It was Snooky by Snooky.
I believe the spring has come at last, said the giant, and he jumped out of bed and looked out. What did he see?
Anyone? Winter.
He saw a most wonderful sight.
Oh.
Through a little hole in the wall, the children had crept in, and they were sitting in the branches of the trees. In every tree that he could see, there was a little child, and the trees were so glad to have the children back again that they had covered themselves with blossoms and were waving their arms gently above the children's heads. The birds were flying about and twittering with delight, and the flowers were looking up through the green grass and laughing. It was a lovely scene, only in one corner, it was still winter. It was the farthest corner of the garden, and in it was standing a little boy. He was so small that he could not reach up to the branches of the tree, and he was wandering all around it, crying bitterly. The poor tree was still covered with frost and snow, and the north wind was blowing and roaring above it. Climb up, little boy, said the tree, and it bent its branches down as low as it could, but the little boy was too tiny. And the giant's heart melted as he looked out. How selfish I have been, he said. Now I know why the spring would not come here. I will put that little boy on the top of the tree, and then I will knock down the wall, and my garden shall be the children's playground forever and ever. He was really very sorry for what he had done. So he crept downstairs and opened the front door quite softly and went out into the garden. But when the children saw him, they were so frightened that they all ran away, and the garden became winter again. Only the little boy did not run, for his eyes were so full of tears that he did not see the giant coming. And the giant stole up behind him and took him gently in his hand and put him up into the tree. And the tree broke at once into blossom, and the birds came and sang on it, and the little boy stretched out his two arms and flung them round the giant's neck and kissed him. And the other children, when they saw that the giant was not wicked any longer, came running back, and with them came the spring. "It is your garden now, little children," said the giant, and he took a great axe and knocked down the wall. And when the people were going to market at 12 o'clock, they found the giant playing with the children in the most beautiful garden they had ever seen. All day long they played, and in the evening they came to the giant to bid him goodbye. "But where is your little companion?" he said. "The boy I put into the tree." The giant loved him the best because he had kissed him. "We don't know," answered the children. "He has gone away." "You must tell him to be sure and come here tomorrow," said the giant. But the children said that they did not know where he lived and had never seen him before, and the giant felt very sad. Every afternoon when school was over, the children came and played with the giant, but the little boy whom the giant loved was never seen again. The giant was very kind to all the children, yet he longed for his first little friend and often spoke of him. "How I would like to see him," he used to say. Years went over, and the giant grew very old and feeble. He could not play about any more, so he sat in a huge armchair and watched the children at their games and admired his garden. "I have many beautiful flowers," he said, "but the children are the most beautiful flowers of all." One winter morning, he looked out of his window as he was dressing. He did not hate the winter then, for he knew that it was merely the spring asleep and that the flowers were resting. Suddenly, he rubbed his eyes in wonder and looked and looked. It certainly was a marvelous sight. In the farthest corner of the garden was a tree quite covered with lovely white blossoms. Its branches were all golden, and silver fruit hung down from them, and underneath it stood the little boy he had loved. Downstairs ran the giant in great joy and out into the garden. He hastened across the grass and came near to the child, and when he came quite close, his face grew red with anger, and he said, "Who hath dared to wound thee?" For on the palms of the child's hands were the prints of two nails, and the prints of two nails were on the little feet. "Who hath dared to wound thee?" cried the giant. "Tell me, that I may take my big sword and slay him." "Nay," answered the child, "but these are the wounds of love." "Who art thou?" said the giant, and a strange awe fell on him, and he knelt before the little child. And the child smiled on the giant and said to him, "You let me play once in your garden. Today you shall come with me to my garden, which is paradise."
Oh my God, he's a dead boy.
He's Jesus.
Oh, he's Jesus.
He is.
Got it.
And when the children ran in that afternoon, they found the giant lying dead under the tree.
Oh my God.
All covered with white blossoms.
I like that one.
And there you have Oscar Wilde's story of the selfish giant.
That's probably my favorite of the ones that you've read so far.
Oh, good. All right.
All right.
You hadn't read that one ever?
No, I haven't heard that one. I like it.
Yeah.
It is a little Grinch-like, though, how he...
Well, yeah, there's always that redemption factor in these stories.
Yeah, but that one seems like... Maybe Dr. Seuss was cribbing a little from Oscar Wilde.
Well, it's a chicken and egg scenario.
Well, not really.
Is it?
Yeah. In what way? Exactly.
I don't know. I've heard Oscar Wilde described as a little bit derivative in his writing.
You think so?
Who's to say he didn't steal from Dr. Seuss?
Theodore Geisel.
In many ways.
Time, probably.
You know, they all steal from each other, I think, don't they? Borrow.
No.
Steal. You know.
Beg, borrow, steal.
I mean, there's certain themes.
Mm. Well, yeah.
Puts in your story.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, do you want to hear the story of the little match girl?
Oh, God.
we're moving. I know. We're moving beyond Christmas now.
Oh, to New Year's.
She's just gonna ruin every holiday.
I know.
I know.
I should be playing a funeral dirge under all these.
We're gonna all be crying.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Funny. Go ahead.
All right. Get it over with.
Poor little match girl.
She hasn't even started yet.
No! Little match girl. There goes any hope I had that this would be depressing.
Alright.
Well, you'll see. Most terribly it was. Most terribly cold it was. Most terribly cold it was. It snowed and was nearly quite dark, and evening, the last evening of the year. In this cold and darkness, there went along the street a poor little girl, bareheaded and with naked feet. When she left home, she had slippers on, it is true, but what was the good of that? They were very large slippers, which her mother had hitherto worn. So large were they, and the poor little thing lost them as she scuffled away across the street, because of two carriages that rolled by dreadfully fast. One slipper was nowhere to be found. The other had been laid hold of by an urchin, and off he ran with it. He thought it would do capitally for a cradle when he some day or other should have children himself. So the little maiden walked on with her tiny naked feet. They were quite red and blue from cold. She carried a quantity of matches in an old apron, and she held a bundle of them in her hand. Nobody had bought anything of her the whole livelong day. No one had given her a single farthing.
The whole livelong day.
She crept along, trembling with cold and hunger. A very picture of sorrow.
She's selling these matches?
Yes. Okay. Hence the little match.
Right. Okay. I don't know if they were like to warm her little naked feet up.
You'll just have to see.
Yeah.
She could marry afford a matchbook on which to light them.
A free matchbook from a bar or liquor store.
There aren't. Well, there probably are bars, but they're called saloons or something.
Pubs.
Pubs. Yeah. Saloons. Pardon.
Yeah. The something tells me it's not called a saloon.
The yeah. Flakes of snow covered their. The flakes of snow covered her long, fair hair, which fell in beautiful curls around her neck. But of that, of course, she never once now thought. From all the windows, the candles were gleaming, and it smelt so deliciously of roast goose. For you know it was New Year's Eve. Yes, of that she thought. In a corner formed by two houses, of which one advanced more than the other, she seated herself down and cowered together. Her little feet she had drawn close up to her, but she grew colder and colder, and to go home she did not venture, for she had not sold any matches and could not bring a farthing of money. From her father she would certainly get blows, and at home it was cold too, for above her she had only the roof.
A few light slams.
A few light slams every now and again.
Thank you, sir. May I have another? Mm-hmm. Through which the wind whistled, even though the largest cracks were stooped up from the straw. Oh, were stopped up with straw and rags.
Does it matter?
She's living in a Molotov cocktail, it sounds like. No. And doused in gasoline.
No. Her little hands were almost numbed with cold. Oh, a match might afford her a world of comfort if she only dare take a single one out of the bundle, draw it against the wall, and warm her fingers by it. She drew one out. Richt. That means right back in the day.
Richt.
In jolly old England.
Richt. I thought that was the sound effect of
that's
lighting
what I
the
thought
match.
Too. I'm like, kind of, I guess.
Richt, that's kind of. How it blazed, how it burnt. It was a warm, bright flame, like a candle, as she held her hands over it. It was a wonderful light. It seemed really to the little maiden as though she was sitting before a large iron stove with burnished brass feet and a brass ornament at top. The fire burned with such blessed influence. It warmed so delightfully. The little girl had already stretched out her feet to warm them, too.
but the small flame went out. The stove vanished. She had only the remains of the burnt-out match in her hand. She rubbed another against the wall. It burned brightly, and where the light fell on the wall, there the wall became transparent like a veil, so that she could see into the room. On the table was spread a snow-white tablecloth. Upon it was a splendid porcelain service, and the roast goose was steaming famously with its stuffing of apple and dried plums. And what was still more capital to behold was the goose hopped down from the dish, reeled about on the floor with knife and fork in its breast, till it came up to the poor little girl. When...
What a nightmare. The goose is alive?
Well...
Cooked goose. It's dancing fork, up to her, I don't think so.
With the knife and fork in its breast.
She's hallucinating.
Oh, she is?
Yeah.
Is the goose so. Jesus?
Yeah. It had two wounds in its hands and its feet. And it said, "Come hither, child, to my paradise."
Alright, so let me just go back then.
The goose is Jesus.
The goose hopped down from the dish, reeled about on the floor. With
like
knife
Jesus
and
would
fork.
Do.
With knife and fork in its breast.
It's sad. Stigmata.
Jesus, could you be any more dramatic?
I know.
Till it came up to the poor little girl when the match went out and nothing but the thick, cold, damp wall was left behind. She lighted another match. Now...
Oh, thank goodness.
Okay.
Alright, so she lights another match.
It's sleepy okay. time over here.
Now there she was.
You're really setting the tone. Giggling throughout her
it's
life.
It's all in the delivery. A comedy or a tragedy.
I can't start over now.
This kid's like on the brink of death and you're just like giggling. She has no shoes and it's like winter in England in 1880 or whatever.
Exactly. She has like her poor little matches of more hallucinating.
Yeah. So, dancing geese.
Dancing geese.
With stigmata.
They hop. It wasn't dancing.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Now there she was, sitting under the most magnificent Christmas tree. It was still larger and more decorated than the one which she had seen through the glass door in the rich merchant's house. Thousands of lights were burning on the green branches, and gaily colored pictures, such as she had seen in the shop windows, looked down upon her. The little maiden The little maiden stretched out her hands towards them when the match went out. The lights of the Christmas tree rose higher and higher. She saw them now as stars in heaven. One fell down and formed a long trail of fire. Someone is just dead. Said the little girl, for her grandmother, the only person who had loved her, and who was now no more, had told her that when a star falls, a soul ascends to God. She drew another match against the wall. It was again light, and in the luster there stood the old grandmother, so bright and radiant, so mild, and with such an expression of love. "Grandmother," cried the little one, "oh, take me with you. You go away when the match burns out. You vanish like the warm stove, like the delicious roast goose, and like the magnificent Christmas tree." And she rubbed the whole bundle of matches quickly against the wall, for she wanted to be quite sure of keeping her grandmother near her. And the matches gave such a brilliant light that it was brighter than at noonday. Never formerly had the grandmother been so beautiful and so tall. She took the little maiden on her arm, and both flew in brightness and in joy so high, so very high, and then above was neither cold nor hunger nor anxiety. They were with God. But in the corner, at the cold hour of dawn, sat the poor little girl, with rosy cheeks and with a smiling mouth, leaning against the wall, frozen to death on the last evening of the old year. Stiff and stark sat the child there with her matches, of which one bundle had been burnt. She wanted to warm herself, people said. No one had the slightest suspicion of what beautiful things she had seen. No one even dreamed of the splendor in which, with her grandmother, she had entered on the joys of a new year.
Well, that was a bummer.
What? She's in heaven. She had a terrible life, and now she's in heaven with God.
You know what that reminds me of?
And her grandmother. What?
There's a Bobby Darin song, Artificial Flowers, and it's like almost identical to that story where the little girl, she's an orphan, but she makes artificial flowers to sell to people, and then she freezes to death, and then she's up in heaven selling real flowers.
Yeah, definitely. See? Heard that story.
He could have. It's a really good song.
He must have. Alright, this is the real story.
Of Christmas?
Christmas.
Okay.
Alright.
According to the Gospel of Luke.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, the real story of the three little pigs.
Yeah.
According to the Big Bad Wolf. I know, yeah. I love that.
That's a Caldecott one.
Probably.
Remember the mitten or whatever? Was that a snow?
Yes!
They have signed copies of that at the Holyoke Barnes & Noble.
Really?
Yeah. Jan something, because it's like a Ukrainian folktale.
Oh, I think we have that.
Yeah, we did have it because
I think we have it at home. Like I think Robin took it from his house.
Yeah, okay.
Home.
Yeah, it's signed at Holy Friends. Oh my gosh. That was cool. I was gonna buy it, a couple copies for people, but it's expensive. Not because
actual sign.
No, not even because it's signed. It just happens to be signed. But like, it was like $20 a thing. Wow. And I'm like, I don't want to buy that. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Okay. About that time, Caesar Augustus ordered a census to be taken throughout the empire. This was the first census when Quirinius was the governor of Syria. Everyone had to travel to his hometown to be accounted for. So Joseph went from the Galilean town of Nazareth up to Bethlehem in Judah, David's hometown, for the census. As a descendant of David, he had to go there.
A Jew.
He went with Mary, his fiancée, who was pregnant. While they were there...
Oh my God!
What?
Oh, this is... Never mind. We knew that. I was about to flip out, but they were going to have a baby out of wedlock. But it was immaculate conception.
Yeah,
so
well, depending on...
While they were there, the time came for her to give birth. She gave birth to a son, her firstborn. She wrapped him in a blanket and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the hostel. There were shepherds camping in the neighborhood. They had set night watches over their sheep. Suddenly, God's angel stood among them, and God's glory blazed around them. They were terrified. The angel said, "Don't be afraid. I'm here to announce a great and joyful event that is meant for everybody worldwide. A Savior has just been born in David's town. A Savior who is Messiah and Master. This is what you're to look for. A baby wrapped in a blanket and lying in a manger." At once the angel was joined by a huge angelic choir singing God's praises. Glory to God in the heavenly heights. Peace to all men and women on earth who please him. As the angel choir withdrew into heaven, the shepherds talked it over. "Let's get over to Bethlehem as fast as we can and see for ourselves what God has revealed to us." They left running and found Mary and Joseph and the baby lying in the manger. Seeing was believing. They told everyone they met what the angels had said about this child. All who heard the shepherds were impressed.
And they were like, "You sure it was only God's glory blazing to them?"
Or
pot.
Oh. That's random.
There was a line that said God's glory blazing.
I know. Oh. I mean the pot thing is...
No, like they were like, "Yeah, right, you, that happened, like you must be crazy."
Oh, I get it. Gotcha. Mary kept all these things to herself, holding them dear, deep within herself. The shepherds returned and let loose, glorifying and praising God for everything they had heard and seen. It turned out exactly the way they'd been told.
Mm-hmm. That's it?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's only Luke.
It's just Luke.
Stupid Luke.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's missing some details in that, huh?
Maybe another book of the Bible will have a more descriptive.
Perhaps.
Oh, yeah.
Probably.
That was a funny thing. But, like, Steve Harvey yesterday when he tried to tweet and apologize for his
terrible blunder. Yeah.
Like, he tweeted, my apologies to Miss Philippians and Miss Columbia, but he spelled Columbia wrong. Yeah. Oh. And he said Philippians instead of Philippians. Oh, my God. On his tweet.
To the Philippians.
No checkers.
And
spell checkers.
Yeah, really. Oh,
my gosh. All right. Here's a warm, witty, short Christmas story. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
It was the day after Christmas at St. Peter and St. Paul's Church in Borden, Kent, England. Father John, the vicar, was looking at the nativity scene outside when he noticed the baby Jesus was missing from the figures. Immediately, Father John's thoughts turned to calling in the local policeman, but as he was about to do so, he saw little Nathan with a red wagon, and in the wagon was the figure of the little infant Jesus.
Jesus.
Jesus. Father John approached Nathan and asked him, "Well, Nathan, where did you get the little infant?" Nathan looked up, smiled, and replied, "I took him from the church." "And why did you take him?" With a sheepish grin, Nathan said, "Well, Father John, about a week before Christmas, I prayed to Lord Jesus. I told him if he would bring me a red wagon for Christmas, I would give him a ride around the block in it."
Aww, that's cute.
Right? Okay.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Is that like a joke?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was a Christmas witticism.
Right? Yeah, it's okay.
Little tiny, teeny
that's
story.
That's kind of cute.
Yeah. All right, this is called The Missing 5-Pound Note. Chippenham George worked for the post office, and his job was to process all the mail that had illegible addresses. One day, just before Christmas, a letter landed on his desk, simply addressed in shaky handwriting, "To God." With no other clue on the envelope, George opened the letter and read, "Dear God, I am a 93-year-old widow living on the state pension. Yesterday, someone stole my purse. It had £100 in it, which was all the money I had in the world, and no pension due until after Christmas. Next week is Christmas, and I had invited two of my friends over for Christmas lunch."
Oh my God, she has friends and she's 92.
93?
Oh my God.
"Without that money, I have nothing to buy food with. I have no family to turn to, and you are my only hope. God, can you please help me?"
Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret.
Chippenham George was really touched and being kind-hearted.
Yeah, is that his name?
Apparently. He put a copy of the letter up on the staff notice board at the main Fareham sorting office where he worked. The letter touched the other postmen, and they all dug into their pockets and had a whip around. Between them, they raised £95. Using an officially franked
in
post
English?
Office, $170.
For real?
Yeah.
How do you know that?
It says
does it have
the...
That's funny.
I just know.
There's just no conversion rate.
Using an officially franked post office envelope, they sent the cash on to the old lady, and for the rest of the day, all the workers felt a warm glow, thinking of the nice thing they had done. Christmas came and went. A few days later, another letter, simply addressed "To God," landed in the sorting office. Many of the postmen gathered around while George opened the letter. It read, "Dear God, how can I ever thank you enough for what you did for me?"
I know. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, I know they're in London or whatever, but...
What?
Read people's mail at the post office.
Yeah.
Can't do that.
I know. "Because of your generosity, I was able to provide a lovely luncheon for my friends. We had a very nice day, and I told my friends of your wonderful gift. In fact, we haven't gotten over it. And even Father John, our parish priest, is beside himself with joy. By the way, there was £5 missing. I think it must have been those thieving fellows at the post office."
That's funny.
Get it?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Well, the... thieving fiends at the post office.
They're the ones who collected all
collected
the money.
Collected the $95, but she's blaming them
for the
because
missing $5
was missing. She asked for 100.
Ah,
remember? Yeah. And yeah. They scrounged up 95.
Oh, yeah.
Which is weird. You'd think one would just throw in the extra five.
I know. Cheapskates.
But then there wouldn't be a joke, would there?
No, there wouldn't.
Speaking of jokes.
Yes, Jessica?
I came prepared with one this week.
All right.
It's for...
It's a Christmas miracle.
I know. And it's in honor of Star Wars opening.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Someone asked me if Star Wars was playing in 3D, and I was like, yeah, but some are 2D, too. Mm-hmm. It was written out. It was hard to figure out how to say it.
Can you say it one more time?
Some are 2D, too. That's okay, yeah, that so is like, hard. R2-D2.
My friend asked me if Star Wars was playing in 3D, and I was like, yeah, but some are 2D, too.
That was good. This is a brain twister.
Yeah, it is.
Not so much a tongue twister.
Right. All right. So here's something. Have you, you do that Elf on the Shelf with Declan, right?
Yeah.
All right, he doesn't buy it.
He doesn't buy it.
He's too smart for a 3-year-old. I told Brayden how he didn't like when you hit him with Joy, right, on top of the... On top of the curtain run, how he started freaking out.
Yeah.
Brayden just thinks it's so funny what a nervous Nelly Declan is about stuff like that.
I know. He was like, she doesn't want to be up there. Can you get her down?
Like
she was a hostage.
Yeah, exactly. Up there. He just thinks it's so funny, like how panicky he gets about things that like a 3-year-old shouldn't be freaking out about.
I know. Poor baby. All right, well, just when you thought Elf on the Shelf couldn't get any creepier, the internet went wild this week with a mixture of joy and fear over a Boston-area Craigslist ad posted by a man offering services as a living Elf on the Shelf.
Oh, God.
For $100 an hour, I will come to your holiday party dressed as the Elf on the Shelf and sit in any location you assign me while I stare emptily at your guests for the duration of the event.
That's kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
The ad reads, I specialize in holiday-themed events, either yours or an unexpecting friend's, but I also offer contracted private investigation and babysitting services.
Oh, yeah.
What?
Right. Jesse Brower, 28, revealed his true name to the Huffington Post in an exclusive interview Thursday, noting that he never expected to become an internet sensation.
Yeah, he did.
Brower told HuffPost he posted the ad as a joke at first. I was thinking about how funny it would be to hire a really creepy guy to sit around to just weird everyone out. Brower actually totally forgot about the ad until Wednesday when it spiked to the top of Reddit and requests for his services came pouring in. Now he said he's beginning to realize that he may have stumbled on a serious business opportunity. The public seems more than willing to pay top dollar to have a random, motionless stranger gaze on their party guests. Brower didn't share any solid future plans, however. He added that previous interviews he's given in character as Chris and Kringle should not be taken seriously, and that the man in the Craigslist photo is not him.
Yeah, because
they're showing, this
that
is like a
comedian. That picture's been going around for like years.
Yeah. He put that on his ad. It's like a comedian.
That's funny.
Can you imagine, like the picture?
It's so eerie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It almost looks like Will Ferrell.
Yeah,
it does do something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, I don't have a poop of the week story for anyone. Sorry.
That's all right. I think we'll get by somehow. We'll pull ourselves together. We're strong people.
Well, we're wishing everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. If we don't get to talk to everyone before New Year, and I will see you girls on Christmas Eve at church, I know.
Mm-hmm.
And then Christmas Day for some fun times.
Yeah.
All right, this was fun. I love you.
Love you.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye.